This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good, good. How are you doing?
Not too bad. Last week we had a replay of one of our shows, The Psychology of Humor. I was going to tell our listeners that the previous week, Dr. Lyle, you came over to the Fasting Escape and spoke, and in my opinion, it's one of the best lectures I've ever heard you do. And
what did we talk about? Was that personality?
Yeah, it was the personality one.
What's that?
Yeah, it was the personality one.
Ah, got it. Okay. Yeah.
And it's not just
cool.
Me. The guests here, the patients here, also said that they've watched all kinds of videos and they really liked that one. And I suspect that it's because you're so good at reading the audience and talking directly to them. And so when it's live, it's like, you know, you're essentially answering everybody's little intricate, detailed questions without them even asking.
Oh, yeah. Just like a miracle.
Yeah, you're...
Okay. Well, I'm glad it went well. All good.
All right.
Oh, no.
It was a lot of fun, though. We had a good time.
Yeah.
And if people want to check that out, Chef AJ actually recorded this one.
Mm-hmm.
And you can look at it on her YouTube or her Facebook live feed. It's called The Perfect Personality. Dr. Lyle Visits the Fasting Escape. It was a really great lecture. Talks more about these concepts that we've talked about here.
Right.
But in any case, this week we've got a couple of questions.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is about older generations versus younger generations. So,
okay.
Dr. Lyle, it seems to me that there's a pattern with the older generation complaining about the younger generation screwing everything up and then talking about the good old days and how things used to be. Is this contempt built into us as we age, particularly the disagreeable and conscientious people? Or is this behavior necessary for the adaptation of the species as the younger generation throws out the less advantageous ideas of the past and then hones the more advantageous ones?
No, that second part is just kind of a bunch of cockamamie theorizing that doesn't have anything to do with evolution. All right, that looks more like cultural speculation. But let's look at this. It's kind of an interesting thing. So we have older people potentially, you know, obviously, I think the pattern is discernible, and they will, you know, these days you can hear them, and I have my whole life hearing the older generation. Occasionally you'll hear negative comments about the younger generation. Now, I can think of multiple reasons off the top of my head why we might hear this from time to time. One reason would be that there's inherently there's a weaning conflict in nature, that between parents and children. The children want to suck up as many resources as they can, and the parents want to move away from the child and move to invest their resources in other reproductive activities for themselves. So this is throughout the animal kingdom, this where children are being provisioned by parents. This is an inherent conflict built into nature, that the children are only 50% related to the parent, but they're 100% related to themselves. And so as a result, there's a conflict of interest. The child would just as soon grab every resource possible. So it's you can imagine that a 40-year-old man facing the 16 or 18 year old children is frustrated with their lack of effort, lack of work, not working hard enough, you know, eating twice as much as they, you know, eating, quote, me out of house and home, is irresponsibly not turning the light bulbs off, and essentially consuming more resources than would be necessary from the standpoint of the 40-year-old father. And you can imagine the just constant grinding irritation at that conflict of interest and the criticism that would be directed from the 40-year-old man to his young teenage children. And you could consider that this would move on as he becomes 45 and the children become 23, and then he becomes 50 and they're 28 and they're still got their hands out. Okay. Now, so at that point, you can sort of hear why you might have the commentary. It's not like you're going to hear it all the time, but there might be a ringing commentary of essentially the lack of work ethic, the lack of diligence, the irresponsibility of today's youth, et cetera. And it could be ringing down these lines. Now, it's also possible that there's truth in it, particularly in the last several generations, in the sense that 100 years ago, people in the United States were an awful lot poorer than they are now. And so 20 years later, the next generation was inevitably in considerably better shape. And therefore, the adults at 40, at any stage of the game, had lived a life that was much rougher economically, quite a bit rougher. The typical change in economic circumstances in the U.S. has doubled in net worth and efficiency about every 24 to 25 years or so. And so that doesn't matter if we're even talking across the Great Depression. It still happened anyway. And so as a result of this, if you think of a generation as being 25 years, which is probably is close to that now, but it was more like 20 years before. But just think of that every generation, in one generation, the youngsters are walking into a world that is twice as wealthy, twice as efficient, and therefore things are easier. They're a hell of a lot easier than they were for the generation 20 or 25 years before. And so that parent looking at the situation, and not just the parent, like I have the same thing that goes on in my head, even through my very sophisticated glasses. I look at 20-year-old children today driving around in very nice, shiny cars and not working very hard compared to how it is that I worked, you know, when I was 18 or 19 years old, you know, 40 years ago. And the reason is everybody's a lot wealthier. And so the extraordinary change in wealth can cause the ease of it in comparative to where we were when we were their age. It's a little ridiculous. And it just seems, it can seem to us, for me now, you're talking almost two doublings. So my 59-year-old eyes looking down the barrel of a 19-year-old today, that 19-year-old is looking at a world that is probably three times wealthier than when I was just 19 years old. So life's a hell of a lot easier. You know, we didn't go out to eat, just go in and get a sandwich at a Togo's or McDonald's when we were 19 years old. We didn't do that, okay? That was way too expensive. That was not typical behavior. That was a big-time treat. And so so things have changed. Things have changed, you know, massively for the better. Today's youth doesn't have to work nearly as hard in nearly as hard of circumstances as the youth of my day. The youth of my day had way better than in my dad's generation. They had to work quite a bit harder. So some of this criticism that you're hearing, I think, has to do with some real changes that have taken place. And you know, obviously for the better. There's no great thing about having to work diligently hard in the salt mine for pennies. So, of course, it's fine that things are better. but we can, the youth can seem sloppy, effectively wealthy, not that diligent, etc. And the truth of the matter is that it's all the same personalities and in general levels of abilities, but they're being played out in much more relaxed circumstances. And so so that's, I think, part of what it is that you're saying. And, of course, finally, I think that there's an issue more broadly of it, as young people challenge older people for positions of authority in legitimate dominance hierarchy conflicts, that's also a threat. And so if I'm a, let's suppose that I'm an aging Hollywood actor that won an Oscar 10 years ago when I was 42 or 15 years ago, and now I'm 57, okay, and now nobody's too interested in hiring me as a leading man anymore. I can feel sour about some 32-year-old that they're going to hire for the leading role, who I feel like isn't, you know, can't shine my shoes as an actor, but he's younger, handsomer, and it's all freaking cool, and he's good enough, and he's going to put he's going to sell tickets. So there's going to be reasons why, the challenge to hierarchies that have been ascended, that could be an issue. The issue of the generational differences in legitimate wealth that can be really substantial and therefore cause differences in the levels of effective conscientiousness that you see in people. And then finally, the actual weaning conflict that would go on, you know, within a family or within a guy's mind about, or within any parent's mind about their own children. All of these are reasons why it is that we might hear this kind of tone from time to time.
Fantastic. I've also heard, like, when I was working at True North, we had one of the patients. I mean, there were several medical doctors that would come in as patients because they saw the value mm-hmm. of fasting. But I yeah. ended up making friends with one of the surgeons who he was just there as a patient. And we yeah. were talking about this and how there's some hazing of medical students going on in the form of sleep deprivation and working them to the bone, you know. And he said that yeah. the attitude was that hazing or that sleep deprivation and that hard work was what surgeons believed made them good doctors. And so they yeah. think that if they do this, it'll make the other person a good doctor, or in essence, weed out the ones who aren't that great anyway.
Interesting. Boy, that's some really terrible, logic, but you could see how they could arrive at such a thing, that essentially a fitness indicator test. But yeah, ridiculous. I mean, and that the fact that goes on today, I don't know. I know that it goes on, you know, to some considerable extent, and that's a sort of an embedded mistake in that system, that it's going to be very hard to pull those weeds out of that garden. It's going to be a long time. Like, bit by bit it's happening, but yeah, that's absurd. And the I don't think that there's economic rationale that really supports it. Perhaps there is, but I don't think so. I don't think that makes any sense. No, I think that there is a completely outmoded way of looking at how to manage the situation of training of doctors. And yeah, that's going to have to die its painful death here over the next couple, 3 decades. Yeah, that's absurd. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, speaking of clinical applications, we segue nicely into the next question. This is from one of our listeners who has a master's in Adlerian psychology. Dr. Lyle,
Adlerian.
I've read evolutionary.
Right.
Yeah, Adlerian. I'm sorry. What did I say?
That's okay.
Adlerian. Am I watching Star Wars?
There you go. All right, go ahead. Sorry.
All right. Dr. Lyle, I've read Evolutionary Psychology 101 by Glenn Gehr and am reading The Selfish Gene. And while evolutionary psychology seems to have a good take on moves and behaviors, I'm not seeing how it's used in therapy and treating entrenched mental illness or behavioral problems. Can you talk about how evolutionary psychology is used in such treatment and how cognitive psychology relates?
Good question. So this is a student, or actually looks, sounds like they completed a master's degree in Adlerian psychology. The Adlerian psychology, that's followers of, I think it was Alfred Adler. He was one of Freud's sort of early disciples in the early 20th century, and then sort of broke away and did his own thing. And, you know, it's psychodynamically oriented thinking. So I guess I didn't know there was a master's degree that you could get in Adlerian psychology, but hey, you know what, there's all kinds of things that you can get. So anyway, good take. Yeah, evolutionary psychology has a good take, all right? That's one of the greatest underestimations in history. Evolutionary psychology is absolutely incredible. I forget what John Tooby had a phrase for it that he used recently, and I somebody's going to have to write to us and tell us what it was. I think he called it magic or super, you know, super.
Yeah, it's
something.
A superpower. Yeah.
Superpower. Thank
you.
Yeah,
we
you.
Went over
superpower.
That a couple shows ago. Is the article?
Yeah.
Evolutionary psychology is a superpower. Yeah.
Right. You bet. It's a superpower.
Good take.
So this our person here has read The Selfish Gene, which is great, and read a little bit. But, yeah, there's a lot more to read and a lot more to understand the in spectacular scope of what these early investigators have uncovered here in the last 25 or 30 years. So you have to read The Moral Animal. Then you have to read, you know, Evolution of Desire by Buss. That will completely revolutionize a person's understanding of man-woman relationships. Then The Mating Mind will, by Miller, will further revolutionize your understanding of motivations of all kinds. The Blank Slate by Pinker is an absolute brilliant magna opus of the field. And then we have Spent by Miller that'll come along and explain consumer behavior. There's more. There's Nicholas Wade, who's published, what is it? It's called A Troublesome Inheritance, which is an extraordinary book outlining the last few thousand years of evolution and changes in personalities essentially around the world, and how this has given rise to differences in political systems and so forth. I mean, so as David Buss has said, evolutionary psychology has a precision and elegance that rivals modern physics. Now, if you're just getting introduced to it, you haven't seen all this, so you've just seen the very, very beginning and the outline, and it doesn't necessarily seem that much fancier than anything else you've read in psychology, but it is. It's completely different. Now, I would say that there's so much to say that I'm just going to have to sort of just talk for a while and then shut up when it makes sense. The relationship to cognitive psychology, that's sort of an interesting part of this question. I have a feeling that the person who wrote this question may be a little bit confused, I'm not sure, about the term cognitive psychology. So they're probably thinking cognitive therapy. Cognitive therapy and cognitive psychology are two different things. So just for everybody's general edification, just to understand that psychology as an academic discipline is currently organized and has been organized for, you know, several decades around sub-disciplines. So it's just as if you're studying the human body. You've got people that study the kidneys, the liver, the lungs, the circulatory system, et cetera. So you hack up the seven major systems of the human body and you study those systems, sort of knowing that they're integrated, but, you know, to each other in some fashion at another level, but understanding that it from one viewpoint, they're an independent system. Now, in the same way that psychology has sub-disciplines within the field of psychology, those sub-disciplines are social psychology, study of you know, dynamic interaction between people. Cognitive psychology is the study of numerous factors in the computations and calculations and perceptual processes that are involved, how the mind works. Then there's going to be clinical psychology, which is actually how on earth you would sit down and try to help anybody. There's physiological psychology that would be studying, you know, nerve mechanisms and how they're hooked up to the brain and how, for example, a satiety mechanism might work, et cetera. The developmental psychology would be studying the process of, you know, taking an embryo up to an adult, up to your old age. In other words, the entire process of maturation. Most developmental psychologists are infinitely interested in the first 2 or 3 years of life because historically we've been so fascinated thinking that huge changes in choice points and variances in outcomes might be being laid, you know, in place in the early years. We now know that that's not true, but that still remains a fascinating thing to watch the human mind come on board and watch the emergence of behaviors as people age. So these are the sub-disciplines. So cognitive psychology is one of those sub-disciplines. So, for example, cognitive psychologists were the people that figured out that all these objects that you see in the world could be broken down and are broken down into the perceptual system and vision into a few simple components. And the brain uses a few simple components to put things, everything together in your mind that you see. The fact that you can take a cup and you can or a bottle of water, for example, and rotate it in your hand or look at it and without moving, you would in principle not know that it's a three-dimensional object. But as soon as you rotate it even a tiny bit, you know, not only are certain that it's a three-dimensional object, but you are also aware that it can't be anything else than what it is that you think it is, because that object is and its shape are uniquely specified by the changing pattern of light that's hitting your retina as that object is under rotation. So that's why you will move your head from side to side to try to see, make sure that you're not looking at a cardboard cutout of Ronald Reagan, you know what I mean, or whether you're looking at the real guy, because as soon as you move your head even a tiny bit, the object that you're seeing is under rotation, and now you can see that Reagan himself would not have looked like that under a little tiny bit of rotation. That must be a cardboard cutout. So, now, that's way too long of an explanation to try to get to what they're asking. So evolutionary psychology is no more or less related to cognitive psychology than it's related to developmental psychology, physiological psychology, social psychology, clinical psychology, or anything else. In other words, it's just simply an overarching theory of psychology as we understand now that the mind is the result of evolutionary processes of natural and sexual selection that have given rise to the characteristics that we call human. Now, I think that what they were saying was they were really asking about how does it relate to cognitive therapy. Now, cognitive therapy has nothing to do with cognitive psychology. Cognitive therapy was just the name or the brainchild of Aaron Beck, who had come up with this different, you know, a sort of a rudimentary, different new way of trying to help people that he called cognitive, okay? So every poor PhD in cognitive psychology in the world has to put up with their aunt saying, oh, so you do cognitive therapy? It's like, no. I'm a cognitive psychologist that studies motion perception, for God's sakes. I have nothing to do with cognitive therapists. So I think that our person was actually asking, what does cognitive therapy have to do with any of this? And the answer would be nothing in principle. Now, however, if we're going to talk about cognitive therapy and what it might have to do with evolutionary psychology and the utility of evolutionary psychology, the answer would be really all therapies of all kinds, from behavior therapy to cognitive therapy to Adlerian therapy and Freudian therapy and any other kind of therapy. At their root, what they're attempting to do, whether explicitly or implicitly, is the removal of distortions. And so the in essence, the notion is that in cognitive therapy, it's the probably the most explicit, that they're basically saying you have what's called cognitive distortions, and we're going to try to take you through various exercises or arguments in order to try to reduce the distortions, with distortions being the cause of your depression and anxiety and misery or whatever else it is. Now, the same thing is true with the application of evolutionary psychology to clinical psychology, which is what it is that effectively I'm doing. The reason the person hasn't seen anything written about this is because there hasn't been anything done to speak of. And so what it is that I have done in the last 30 years is I have been applying what has been learned in evolutionary psychology to the problems of clinical psychology in a way, in other words, using an overarching frame of understanding the motivations and the nature of humans and trying to understand how it is that we're going to go about and help them from a more precise, less naive version of understanding motivation in general. So, distortions can have multiple sources. So one of those sources, for example, is your genes. So you inherit, you know, your personality, and your personality, the more unusual that personality is, the more likely it is that it's going to have a distorted understanding of the way other people think and possibly and optimal behavior. So, for example, if you are born with very low conscientiousness, you might be an agreeable, nice person and pretty smart, but if you're real low in conscientiousness, you're just not going to quite get it together and get your bills paid. And you may not go to the dentist, and your teeth are going to rot out. You're going to do a lot of stupid stuff. In other words, you will underinvest in conscientious behavior, and you will wind up with some bad outcomes as a result of that. And so that's genetic. In other words, your genes have essentially built your mind with a variant that that is not very successful, which is why it is that there aren't very many of them in the gene pool, because they've been selected out. Alternatively, your genes could have built you, you could have genes that are hyper-conscientious, at which point you don't have very many kin either. if you're hyper-conscientious, you are, you know, checking and checking and checking things and trying to make sure everything's right and can't turn in your term paper, and, you know, until you've had it reviewed 17 times by 17 different people, and then you can't even turn it in at all because you just feel like it's not properly done, and God knows what other problems that you might have. So the once again, gene variation causing gene variation causing distortions in a person's understanding of appropriate cost-benefit analysis for behavior, leading to suboptimal outcomes, et cetera. So that's one look at distortions. I actually don't know of another theory in psychology that would integrate anything like that. That evolutionary psychology in principle, or actually most of the commentators in evolutionary psychology aren't talking too much about personality, but that's just because they haven't kind of gotten to it yet. But the notion that personality variation, which is driven by gene variation, is causing distortions in people's thinking and behavior, and leading to clinical outcomes that are problematic, that is a direct derived set of inferences leading right out of evolutionary theory. Now, the notion that a person's learning history, that they have been through things, they've been, I don't know, slapped by their uncle, they got turned down for a date by Susie, and that really hurt their feelings, that they lost three jobs in a row, lost their confidence, et cetera. Whatever happened, in other words, the notion that your learning history has caused you to have a distorted view of reality and thereby make decisions in the present that are not optimal. And so this is the concept that the environment that you've lived in is not representative of the environment that you're living in now. and therefore the inferences that you have made as a result of living in the previous environment are not valid. They are misrepresentations. So, for example, if you had had three jobs and they all had paid you $11 an hour, and you had been sitting on this $11 an hour job for the last 14 years, and you're completely isolated socially, and nobody told you that, in fact, given your skill level, you could make $22 an hour somewhere else, then your understanding of your environment would be distorted. And learning that and your learning history would not be representative of the environment as it actually is. Now, you can see that, in principle, everybody's learning history is distorted, which it is. And everybody's genes are distorted, which they are. So it isn't as if there's such a thing as living free from distortion. The only question is whether or not your distortions are problematic enough that they're causing you to behave in ways that are suboptimal for what would be, you know, ultimately in your best interest. And as a result of that, you're doing some suffering that is unnecessary. And the only thing that is required to correct that suffering would be more, you know, essentially better information or a removal of distortion. Psychotherapy isn't going to change your genes, but it could absolutely change your learning history. So if someone comes into me and asks me a question about how they think the world works, and I ask them, and then I find out that they're wrong, okay, that they heard from listening to Andrew Weil that the way that they should get healthier is to eat more lard from a grass-fed hog, okay? And I'm going to tell them, no, actually, that isn't a good thing to do, and here's why, and let's chart out, and let's look at some evidence so that you can now learn that you shouldn't be eating lard from a grass-fed hog, and that's not going to be in your best interest. So in other words, by educating people as to the nature of the actual contingencies in the environment, we should be able to improve people's functioning. So the notion is, can we do this? And cognitive therapy had a nice little concept, which is the concept of experiments, in order to try to test ideas in a way to try to get to the heart of whether or not someone's underlying hypothesis was more likely to be correct or less likely to be correct. Good ideas. Now, also, you could have distortions in your brain because there's been an assault on the brain's integrity through drugs, injury, psych meds, fatigue, etc., things like that. Not that important, theoretically, except for the psych meds part and the drugs part, I suppose. A big theoretical issue in evolutionary psychology's application to clinical problems is the mismatch between Stone Age algorithms that were built to solve survival and reproductive problems in that environment versus the modern circumstances. So some high school kid who's got dumped by Susie and is suicidal, which, by the way, is a major cause of teenage suicide. That is a distortion, because in the Stone Age, when you lose a mate, that could be a big deal. You might not get another one. It's only 2,000 people on the planet 83,000 years ago. So now you have a situation where losses that would have been potentially catastrophic in the Stone Age are actually trivial in the modern environment, but they don't feel trivial, particularly for young people who haven't found out that, guess what, you get to lose Susie 10 more times just between now and the time you're 25. You got a lot of heartache coming, kid. But the good news is there's always another way. Now, so there's several, there's threats to human psychology, or their good functioning, as a result of the mismatch between Stone Age and modern algorithms. Things like the pleasure trap, i.e. supernormal stimuli, the widespread, pretty major problems resulting from that. The problem of the ego trap, being the bar set too high by social cues, and then having being perpetual, so that unlike the Stone Age, where if you were given too much credit for something, you got to dance in the sun for a couple of weeks, but pretty soon you got to give it back. In the modern environment, they give you the, you know, Emily Dickinson Award in the eighth grade for your poetry, and then you're terrified the rest of your life and you're in an ego trap the whole ride. It's a mess. So the potential perpetual ego trap of the modern environment where you can hide and escape and not reach your potential through competitive necessity the way you did in the Stone Age, that's a problem. The notion of pseudo-esteem, the fact that there are two normal Stone Age mechanisms of esteem, which are self-esteem, which is generated from your internal audience observing your efforts, and then there's esteem, the actual feedback from real-life people in terms of rating and analyzing what it is that you have to trade relative to others in the major domains of life, those being mating, friendship, and trade. And it's going to turn out that as villages got bigger and we got more people than we could know their names, pretty soon what we're going to have is a phenomenon known as reputation. And that's going to be pseudo-esteem. And so in the last 10,000 years, we've witnessed the extraordinary phenomenon of people looking for cues of how much esteem you've earned rather than actually the actual esteem process itself. And it gets all the way to ridiculous. So it gets ridiculous to the point of people taking pictures that look cool and posting them on Facebook rather than actually enjoying their existence and actually enjoying real live esteem process with anybody. They're an awful lot more interested in the pseudo-esteem that they might get from looking cool to people that they don't even know or barely know. So this is a threat in the modern environment that essentially what pseudo-esteem is, I mean, it's an inevitable byproduct of a world that has trading potentials that go beyond first degree knowledge of individuals. So there's no stopping it, and there's nothing wrong with it in principle, but it's incredibly seductive when it comes to of the theoretical leverage that can come from it, that your reputation can be more important than what it is that you can actually accomplish or would. And so you can see how this could draw, this is effectively supernormal stimuli. It is effectively the pleasure trap of the esteem processes in the modern age. And that's a fiasco. And so what was beginning to be evident in, I don't know, the 1950s called Keeping Up with the Joneses, now comes full circle to, you know, potentially grabbing a hold of the human mind and not letting it go, as it is happening in the cases of some people, where the concern over gains and losses of pseudo-esteem is dominating their motivation as opposed to the gains and losses of self-esteem and esteem. So that's another threat. Another threat, this is sort of directly, these things are, you know, most penetratingly and clearly understood through the lens of evolutionary psychology. Now, the notion of hill climbing, climbing dominance hierarchies, etc., this is incidentally described well by Adler 100 years ago and others, but Adler made a big fuss out of this in essentially the notion, just for people's edification, Adler saw status or striving for superiority and the concerns about being inferior as being central to human motivation. He was certainly right in terms of he was operating in the right territory. He had a lot of psychodynamic baggage that he brought along with it. But, you know, throughout the centuries, very good minds were good, had good descriptions. You know, they were good observers. That's what Hollywood is. When they hit a movie right, you know, they don't understand evolutionary psychology, but they've got an intuition about the nature of psychology, and, you know, they get a lot of pieces right. So Adler wouldn't have understood and couldn't possibly have understood what the motivations were behind the striving for superiority. He would not have known that these were algorithms designed to compete for advantages that would ultimately result in increased likelihood of gene survival. So that, however, you can go back and connect some of these observations of people that had come before us and recognized that they were recognizing truths. Another problem of the modern age is the loss of deep connection that we talked about before, and also the marriage is a major potential threat to human happiness as a result of essentially having social and financial and therefore cultural and religious expectations of a 50-year relationship when you have a 5-year chip that was evolved to help you make intermediate-level mating decisions. And now we're trying to force that chip to make decisions it wasn't designed for. So at the same time, although we have these considerable threats from the modern environment and the mismatch between Stone Age algorithms, we also have opportunities. We have birth control. We have a village that we can choose and put together rather than the one that we're stuck with. We can have temporary status losses, loss of job, loss of mate, loss of esteem because of mistakes that we made, which can be corrected and actually completely mitigated in our futures in a way that you might not have been able to mitigate those in the Stone Age. You can, as I said, change partners, and we're not under the you can change partners and actually have a wider range of ability to find people that are far more appropriate for who it is that we are and what it is that we enjoy in people than we ever had before. We can essentially afford to make more mistakes than you could have made in the Stone Age among a variety of dimensions. And with respect to finances and other issues, you can operate from a position of power where you can actually afford to have things go wrong and still be okay. In the Stone Age, many times you couldn't. So the modern environment has vast opportunities for increasing human happiness. It also has traps that are potentially threats. And viewing both the threats and opportunities of the current circumstances for people, this is the sort of foundation for the application of evolutionary psychology to clinical problems. All right, I think that's a good place to stop.
Now that's fantastic, Dr. Lau. That's I think no one's ever disappointed when you go into more detail. But
okay, well, at least not that they're speaking up. All right,
yeah, just cut them off.
Yeah.
Well, the next question is a clinical issue. So it's actually now getting into a specific issue. Particular listener says, Dr. Lyle, I'm a 22-year-old male, and since childhood, I've been having trouble maintaining long-term relationships, romantic or friendships. My big five is openness, high conscientiousness, low extroversion, low agreeableness, and high neuroticism. I wanted to ask if you have any advice for people with this personality type when it comes to maintaining relationships. Or, if not meant to be, where do you think a person like this should look to find happiness? How important is it in... Also, another question is, how important is it in romantic relationships that both parties share a similar IQ?
Wow, what a tremendous question. first of all, I would say... 22-year-old male having trouble with romance. Join the party. All right. So my heart doesn't quite bleed for the kid. Because you got a lot of time to sort some of these things out. And for all we know, some of the troubles that this person is having are troubles of young people growing up, making mistakes, learning how to do things a little bit differently, learning through some difficult experiences, et cetera. Okay? Now, in terms of what it is that he might do things differently, as we would look at, if we're looking at his profile, we can see some reasons why that he might be having some difficulty. So, high conscientiousness, low agreeableness, high neuroticism. This is a formula for someone who's pretty uptight and kind of difficult you know, could be difficult if other people aren't doing things that are perfect. And it looks like it's a little bit irresponsible, and now he's upset, and he's going to voice that. So now that, you know, that looks like Alan Goldhammer's personality, except he's very stable. So Alan would just look at people, be disgusted that they're doing things improperly, and feel irritable about wanting to tell them, but at the same time he'd be so stable that he just wouldn't say anything. Just let him suffer. So he's having a similar relationship to reality, but not quite. Now, I would say that one thing, if you recognize that you got some disagreeability chips, there's a decent formula to keep in your head that I read, you know, many years ago by the basketball coach John Wooden. And that is, in the fine art of friendship, be willing to go more than halfway. Now, the average person is is a slightly self-interested traitor, more than a little slightly, but not terrible. They're pretty reasonable, which is why most people can do pretty well in the friendship arena, why we've got a cooperative species that makes use of the cooperation. And the cooperation benefits outweigh the costs, or we wouldn't be as friendly as we are. The disagreeable genes are no doubt are in the population because they still work in terms of exploiting people that are more agreeable. And so if you are disagreeable, one of the things that you need to understand in principle is that we're gonna call you a 70-30 traitor. Okay? So that means that you're going to be irritable, and you're going to think you're right, and you're going to think that you're fair, and the truth is you are going to be distorted fairly often. And so this is an example of us attempting to try to help this person patch a characteristic that they have, and we're probably not going to be very successful, but we may be a little bit successful when it counts. So when you are with someone that you care about and you're starting a romantic relationship and you actually like the girl, then the right thing to do is remember, go more than halfway, okay? this is just a good strategy for long-term relationships in general between men and women. Go more than halfway. So now the thing is that you can test this. And see whether or not it seems to be helpful, whether you get over a lot of bumps. Just, you know, choke it down, go more than halfway. Now, you don't have to go 80%, but if you make a conscious habit of going where you think it's 60-40 the other person's direction, then you get to test whether or not the relationship works more smoothly and better with that kind of a strategy and whether or not it's worth it. Okay? So, but in general, I'll say my tagline at the bottom of this thing is that what this person really needs is to find a saint. Yeah, and such people exist. Okay, so turns out that one of my best friends is high openness, high conscientiousness, and high disagreeable. And it turns out that he found a saint, and he married that saint. And they are married today, 30 years later, or 28 years, no, about 30 years later. And, you know, great people, both of them. So even if you are somewhat of a difficult match, in theory, there's a cover for every pot. You know what you're looking for. You're looking for somebody that is high enough conscientiousness that's not going to grate on you, and a pretty high degree of agreeableness. That's our individual that could fit this person well. Now, when it comes to how important it is in romantic relationships that both parties share similar IQ, all these kinds of issues, we don't solve these issues from the left brain analytically. you must solve them only through the right brain, i.e. through your intuition. I use left brain and right brain just metaphorically because that's how it's been talked about in the last 50 years. It's your intuition versus a reasoning process. And the reason I say this is that you are on all of the personality dimensions. In general, the only two where opposites attract is in agreeable or disagreeable. And agreeable people are not attracted to disagreeable people, but they're just so easygoing that they're willing to put up with them. Whereas disagreeable people are absolutely attracted to agreeable people because effectively they get their way more often than the only people that they've ever met that are halfway reasonable. But along the rest of the dimensions, people actually have a bandwidth of acceptability that the people have to be reasonably similar to them because these dimensions will ultimately be a problem. And if the person is sufficiently different than you, you will probably find that you will have to rule them out. You don't have any choice. So if you're very conscientious and the person is beautiful and open and funny and agreeable, but to the point they're a flake, it's going to eventually drive you crazy. Okay. So the point is that people have to be reasonably well matched, and well matching on any dimension, including intelligence, it needs to be enough that the people, you know, do not feel that irritation or disgust with where the other person's at. That's death to romantic love. And the thing is that you don't have to worry about it because it takes care of itself. You could meet somebody and think that they were smart enough, and then after you interact with them for a little while, you've been with them for a couple, 3 weeks, it's like, well, actually, they're not. Okay, and it took a while for you to figure that out. Alternatively, you could think that they're not smart enough, but it turns out that as you hang out with them longer and you're physically attracted to them and other things are going well, it turns out that they're within a latitude of acceptance and you're fine with it. So these things are not things that you essentially have to think about. They're kind of interesting since we know top down now, we can look at these major characteristics and we can actually observe these dynamics. And you can get very facile about this as you size people up. But what you can't do is you can't know your own latitude of acceptance by a score on a sheet on anything. You discover your latitude of acceptance by your interacting with the individual.
All right. Fantastic, Dr. Lasso. Yeah, the guy's 22, so he's got a long way ahead of himself.
Don't expect any luck or any success for the next 10 years.
I guess we'll ask this next week, but there was a question buried in some of the questions that can this cause a great deal of frustration with young men that they're essentially being competed by the older men who, 30, 40, 50 plus men who have already been established and they're essentially getting the younger women, the more attractive women.
Oh yeah, whatever. Everybody's got a bitch. Everybody's complaining about their competitive position and everybody's unhappy about it. The older guys are like, gee, the younger guys are handsomer and the 35-year-olds are interested in the 28-year-olds. And so, I'm 40 and I'm getting screwed there. Nobody's happy. I've never met anybody who was really happy with their competitive situation. And if I did, I'd be irritated with them. Okay, I think that's enough for one night, Nate.
All right, Dr. Lau, pleasure speaking with you. We'll talk to you all next week.
Okay, sounds good.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.